Nuclear shutdown. Pushing back against the money, greed, and power of those who gain the most from the continuance of nuclear reactors is a battle that presents seemingly insurmountable odds. It's a modern David and Goliath tale being fought in communities around the world. And it's easy for an individual to give up hope, throw in the towel, try to ignore the problems, even though you can't, and let the nuclear perpetrators get away with whatever they want because, hey, how can a handful of individuals ever win over rich multinational corporations and utilities? But then you learn about a film, one that chronicles step by step what it took to shut down Southern California's two-reactor site at San Onofre, situated on the ocean between San Diego and Los Angeles. It's a film that addresses not only the thrilling results, but the process it took to achieve them. And when you have a chance to talk with the filmmakers, you ask, how did it happen? And one of them tells you,
citizens. That's been an important part of this whole story, and that's why we wanted to show the process of citizen action impacting the eventual shutdown, even though Edison wanted to diminish that impact. It's really significant, and we wanted to use that as an encouraging example for other people to follow and to see that it really is possible for a small handful of really well-informed, persistent citizens to have an impact on City Hall.
Well, when you've had the chance to see the new film, SOS, San Onofre Syndrome, and watch regular people rise to the challenge of shutting down a dangerously flawed set of nuclear reactors, you become empowered with the sense that with diligence and determination, anything is possible. And there just might be a way out of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, I am excited to bring you an interview with two of the three directors of the new film, SOS, San Onofre Syndrome. We talk with Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle of EON, the Ecological Options Network. Their film will have its world premiere on October 8 in Los Angeles and follow up 1 week later with a live stream through the Awareness Film Festival, so anyone, anywhere can view it. And trust me, you will want to. We will also have nuclear news from around the world and more honest nuclear information than indicted U.S. Senator Bob Menendez was ever bribed to talk about. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 26, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., a lot of action on the call to extend and expand the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act, or RECA. Senators Josh Hawley, of all people, a Republican of Missouri, and Ben Ray Lujan, a Democrat from New Mexico, led a bipartisan press conference in support of an amendment that would both expand and extend RECA. The original RECA passed in 1990 with the goal of compensating Americans who had health problems, such as cancer, due to Cold War-era nuclear testing and radiation exposure. Originally, the law covered those who were residents of parts of Utah, Nevada, and Arizona, but did not cover those affected by the Trinity test of the atomic bomb in Los Alamos, New Mexico. The amendment would expand eligibility to then-residents of Idaho, Colorado, Montana, New Mexico, and Guam, and also extend eligibility to uranium miners who were exposed through 1990. A rally held in D.C. included representatives of the activist and downwinder community from Utah and North St. Louis. They were joined by Navajo Nation Council Speaker Kristalyn Curley and Navajo Nation Washington Office Executive Director Justin Ahasteen and members of the Navajo Uranium Radiation Victims Committee. Senator Hawley is quoted as saying, "If the government is going to expose its own citizens to radioactive material for decades, the government ought to pay the bills of the men and women who have gotten sick because of it. They ought to pay for the survivor benefits of those who have been lost." Idaho National Labs has confirmed that they had no fire. This after social media pictures posted appeared to show smoke coming from the site. They claim that it was steam being released by the reactors, but that did not stop 24 hours of panic when nothing contradicted the story of the fire. A Nuclear Regulatory Commission inspection found two security violations at the Davis-Besse Nuclear Power Plant in Ohio associated with complacency and what they call a lack of conservative bias. The security force of the plant is reportedly under stress due to rampant cost-cutting. The NRC also found three cybersecurity violations at Beaver Valley Nuclear Plant in Pennsylvania, to which Edwin Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists stated, "There seems to be a big cyber problem across the fleet. No wonder why industry wants NRC to reduce the inspection frequency from once every 2 to every 4 years." Over to Japan, where the Environment Ministry has reported that construction workers illegally took and sold potentially radioactive scrap material from the vicinity of the remains of the Fukushima nuclear power plant. According to Mainichi Shinbun, several building workers have repeatedly, on at least 7 occasions between April to June, removed untested and potentially nuclear-contaminated waste, they mean radioactive, waste iron and copper wire away from the construction site of the Okuma Town Library and Folklore Heritage Museum and sold them, yielding a profit of about 900,000 Japanese yen or about $6,100 U.S. dollars. According to Da Zhizheng, director of the Institute of Northeast Asian Studies, the transportation and trading of untested scrap iron and copper wire may lead to the spread of radioactive substances and trigger social panic. The incident is another example of Japan's inability to properly handle the nuclear accident and reinforce what he calls people's sufficient reason to believe that there are huge safety risks and loopholes in its dumping of nuclear-contaminated wastewater. Speaking of Japan and TEPCO's plans to dump 1.3 million tons of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, what's being labeled international blowback has already begun. At the Seafood Expo Asia, which ran from September 11 to 13 in Singapore, there were reports of customers pulling back orders, widespread order cancellations, and suppliers looking to diversify its customer base, meaning they're reaching out to sell in Europe. After the nuclear disaster in 2011, 55 countries and regions imposed restrictions on imports of Japanese food products. As of mid-August, import bans remain in place in 7 countries and regions, including China, Hong Kong, Macau, South Korea, and Taiwan. While here in the U.S., members of our House of Representatives are chowing down on sushi. In Canada, 12 internationally recognized nuclear experts have sent an open letter to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau expressing new concerns over nuclear weapons proliferation risks associated with a government-funded nuclear reprocessing project in New Brunswick. The authors cite new information obtained through Access to Information, the Canadian version of the Freedom of Information Act, that reveal a government policy-making process on reprocessing in collaboration with the International CANDU Owners Group. This activity runs counter to the G7 statement that Canada endorsed in Hiroshima on May 19 of 2023, pledging, quote, "to reduce the production and accumulation of weapons-usable nuclear material for civil purposes around the world." In Germany, a country which pledged to take all nuclear reactors offline after Fukushima and took its last 3 nuclear reactors offline in April, A minister has announced plans for fusion nuclear power plant as soon as possible, at a cost of more than 1 billion euros over the next 5 years. Poland's environmental agency has greenlit the country's first nuclear power plant. It is one of several countries set to receive financial help for this from the U.S. for new nuclear technology. In Kenya, a training to enlighten residents on the effects of a nuclear reactor being proposed for the area was broken up by police, saying it was illegal, except it wasn't. And in Ulkan, Kazakhstan, a village slated to host a nuclear power plant, residents are responding with fierce debate, led by fishermen who fear that the local lake will be affected and that fishing there could eventually be banned. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, the Trinity A-bomb test, Church Rock uranium tailing spill, uranium mining, radioactive waste dumps, Nevada test site. Add to that Chernobyl, Fukushima, Three Mile Island, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the Marshall Islands, and too many more. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters is as endless as the dangers of plutonium, which has a radioactive half-life of 24,000 years. Every week, Nuclear Hot Seat reports on stories of how the nuclear industry perpetuates itself despite the known risks, how brave activists from around the world are fighting back against it and for genuine renewables, and how any one of us can take action to help stop this atomic madness. We get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, as well as a healthy dose of skepticism, providing you with a much deeper and nuanced telling than you would ever expect to find on mainstream media, so you can actually understand what's going on. Every week, there's fresh information, interviews, an unrelenting perspective, and even, when possible, humor. But in order to keep this work going, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and it seems we're always falling short. So how about $5, the same as you would spend in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista? Or buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5. Of course, be it one-time or ongoing, your donation can be any amount. All of it is needed and appreciated. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donations are tax-deductible. So just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Donate right now. And whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview, and it is a joy. When I first became involved in nuclear issues, after Fukushima, I went to meetings and protests in Southern California, knowing little, asking lots, and learning who the players were in this battle against nuclear threats and dangers, most specifically here in my own backyard. San Onofre is only 70 miles from my home, and I took its presence personally. From the first events I attended, there was this couple with much better than cell phone cameras and sound equipment, and they were shooting footage of everything, every time. As I learned, Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle have long been dedicated to documenting activist pushback against the entrenched nuclear industry. Their company, EON, Ecological Options Network, is dedicated to supporting grassroots movements working for planetary and human rights through deep democracy. Documentary films take a long time to put together, in this case, more than 12 years. But the result of Jim and Mary Beth's Herculean efforts is well worth the wait. This extraordinary film presents a roller coaster ride of hope, crushing setbacks, and persistence. It cites dozens of genuine experts, many of whom I've interviewed here on Nuclear Hot Seat, and puts together the best sound bites from those passionate, persistent activists. The film paints the picture of betrayal, manipulation, and lies by an industry that cares not one whit about people and the environment. But it's not just talking heads. There's animation to bring otherwise dry statistics to visual life, historic newscasts, horrifying footage from Fukushima, as well as San Onofre, and it's all woven together in a seamless narrative based on human lives that never lags, always engages, and leaves one with a massive impulse to get involved. And if it sounds like, at times, I'm taking this personally, you're right. I spoke with Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle on Friday, September 22nd, 2023. Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle, it's so great to finally be able to welcome you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
We're honored.
First of all, congratulations, standing ovation. Your film, SOS San Onofre Syndrome, is powerful, ultimate, and a perception-changing film on the nuclear mess at San Onofre and far beyond. And as is clear from the excellence of the way this film is put together, this ain't your first rodeo. Briefly, what's your background as filmmakers?
I guess it begins with me learning how to use my father's 8mm camera. After that, I went to film school in Britain and then worked on various productions. And then I began teaching filmmaking at various universities in this country, University of Wisconsin in Madison and Concordia University in Montreal, and eventually escaped academia and went freelance. And I've been doing it ever since. The most successful move in my career was hooking up with Mary Beth.
Oh, and when I found out Jim's background, I thought, aha, this is the person for me. He's going to teach me how to be a filmmaker.
Can you imagine having somebody say, as she said to me, just figure out what you want to do and I'll make it happen? And she has.
So you've made other films happen in the past. This one has been cooking for a very long time. I only joined the anti-nuclear movement after Fukushima. It was the first time I got my legs under me after Three Mile Island. And one of my first memories from my earliest post-Fukushima activism was seeing the two of you hanging on to impressive cameras, recording meeting and events that I went to throughout Southern California. How long have you been covering Southern California's anti-nuclear movement and specifically San Onofre?
Well, you know, right after Fukushima started, and I say started because it's definitely ongoing, we realized, oh my God, as filmmakers and anti-nuclear activists, we must take it on ourselves to try to prevent a Fukushima from happening here in California. And that's when we worked with others across the state to help revive the former strong anti-nuclear movement, again, to close our last two remaining operating nuclear power plants, which were also, just like Fukushima, surrounded by earthquake faults and in tsunami zones. So we've been doing this since 2011.
You're not from the Los Angeles or Southern California area, so you had to travel to cover all the many meetings and demonstrations and events that you did record. What moved and motivated you to keep covering it so consistently? I mean, you never dropped a beat. I always saw you no matter where I showed up.
Yeah, that was part of the problem because we accumulated thousands of hours that we then had to go through.
We set out to cover both Diablo Canyon and San Onofre, and it became increasingly evident, particularly once we started working with an editor, that it was just too big a story. We had to break it in two pieces, and we're still hoping to do the Diablo Canyon syndrome after we get through putting this out in the world to make its way.
That was one of the astonishing things, because the breadth and the depth of the information, the people you interviewed, the experts, the genuine experts, many of whom I've had on the show, some of whom I count as personal friends now, who were featured in the show, is astonishing. And you would take someone like Dan Hirsch from the Committee to Bridge the Gap, and you would take a brilliant sentence or two sentences that he would have said that I know must have been from like an hour or two of talking. How in the world did you approach this mountain of material to put it into the precise, clear, and informative order that you did?
Well, we had to develop a timeline, and of course we had transcripts, and we gradually put it together with the help of our brilliant editor, who happens to be Mary Beth's niece, Morgan Peterson. She's also the co-director of this piece.
Because she figured it out. I mean, she really pulled the storylines through, digging through thousands of hours. I mean, really, she did an incredible job.
Was the editing ongoing as you were working on this, or did you wait until you got to an end point to see what you had and put it together?
No, well, it was ongoing.
Yeah, it was ongoing. Well, actually, the construction of this particular piece, I guess, began 7 or 8 years ago when we began to feel like we had a hold of something.
Yeah, and we first thought we were going to be focusing on shutting down, and then we realized, no, that's just the first part of the story. In fact, there was a byline that we got very attached to, which was, shutdown is only the beginning, unfortunately.
You broke the film into two parts, and it was almost like a two-part series on television or the like, because the first part was so much about what did it take to shut it down. Mm-hmm. And I was at a vast number of those meetings. I didn't show up on camera in any of it.
Yes, you did. Yes, you were. You were in the front row at NeotaCon's event. You're sitting in the front row.
There I am taking my notes and sticking my recorder in front of whoever would talk to me. That was part of the astonishment of who you had in. I mean, you had former Prime Minister of Japan, Naoto Kan, who was in charge during Fukushima. You had so many people from Edison who I recognized, though you didn't catch Tom Palmisano in the middle of one of his grand mal physical physics, which is, talk about a tell from a poker game. This guy had a tell for the fact that he was really under a lot of pressure and not telling the truth, because he would twitch every time he started saying certain things. Plus, the range of the activists, some of whom are no longer with us. I mean, to see Jean Stone and
Barbara George,
who you dedicated the film to, who was such a valiant worker in dealing with the California Utilities Commission. She knew chapter and verse on them. Did you find that it was difficult dealing with so many different people, or that you had a difficulty honing in on which ones became more a part of the narrative as opposed to drop-ins?
Yeah, it's hard, you see, because there's so many wonderful activists with so many points of view that make such wonderful contributions. And we just had to focus on how to tell the story in the most personalized way. Remember, Eisenhower said that the only way to defend against the danger that he saw looming was informed, vigilant citizens. And that's been an important part of this whole story, and that's why we wanted to show the process of citizen action impacting the eventual shutdown, even though Edison wanted to diminish that impact. It's really significant, and we wanted to use that as an encouraging example for other people to follow and to see that it really is possible for a small handful of really well-informed, persistent citizens to have an impact on City Hall.
It was really hard to leave anybody out, and that's why at the end, over the credits, we have flashes of so many of the wonderful people that did work on it. And we also dedicated this to Burton Muldo, who also was a safety advocate at San Onofre for many years. He also has passed on.
Yeah, and Jean Stone passed on. And kids grew up during this. So you noticed in the film, the Johnson family moves from babyhood into speaking at the microphone themselves. It's really quite wonderful.
And doing an excellent job of it. That was, I think, such a valuable part of the film, that you did show the process of the activists coming together and how the powers that be did everything in their power to thwart the citizens speaking the truth, down to limiting how long you could speak and what you could speak on and when you could speak at these meetings. I think one of my favorite moments in the entire film was when Torgon Johnson, explained that, well, they were limiting us. They would not let us do a 15-minute presentation with everything we wanted to say. So we broke it down into 3-minute segments. We stood in line, we went in order, and when one person stopped, the next person picked it up. And in that way, the entire presentation was given. It was just given by different voices. I thought that was a brilliant piece of information and one that could be emulated by groups anywhere.
Yeah, we really wanted people to know that. That's the way you magnify the individual voices and meld them into a continuous joint voice.
Also, I want to mention that it was a perfect storm, actually, that made them shut the reactors down and close it down for good, because it was not only the citizens' grassroots efforts, it was also the legal push that Friends of the Earth was able to make through the ASLB, which is the subset legal court of the NRC. They knew that they had them on a legal principle that they weren't going to get out of. And so it was a perfect storm between all the organizing at the bottom and the legal assault too, or defense.
Yeah, it isn't just citizen pressure in the streets. It's also the pressure in the courts and the appropriate venues for legal action.
We also were blessed with the totally unexpected yet brilliantly placed Donna Gilmore, who before Fukushima didn't know anything about this, didn't do anything about this, and happened to live in a beautiful home facing the ocean in San Clemente. And then she discovered she was only 5 miles away from San Onofre and started digging. The narrative following her through this, from admitting that she was a naive local resident, all the way through having members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say that she had been educating them, which indeed she had through her research, and then to the final sadness, I won't mention what it is, but it deals with her home, I thought was a real through line that people could hang their awareness and their attention on. How someone came from out of nowhere in particular, who bought in, who dedicated herself, and who did the hard work every step of the way to be part of this and to provide the research on what was wrong, especially when it came to the storage of the materials.
Definitely. We were so blessed that she's got incredible researching skills and analytical prowess. I mean, because when you get right down to it, we're still searching for other people who have done that scope, breadth and depth into the storage issues, because it's not their favorite subject. A nuclear engineer in school, storage is an elective. Yes, Donna just found that out. And, you know, why would they want to take an elective on storing when the real sexy parts of the nuclear allure are not there? And it's incredibly important that Donna did that deep dive.
So this film honors a whole raft of activists who turned themselves into experts, maybe did not have the training or the background or the college prep courses for this, but through their own diligence and their own study, became experts, became spokespeople, became those individuals who knew the truth and could speak it and point it out to others. I was thrilled to realize that I knew personally probably 3/4 of the people who spoke on our side, on the side of shutting down San Onofre and having safe storage. And beyond that were people who I had interviewed already for the show in depth. And what heartened me was how precise you were in selecting the sweet spot of their knowledge and their articulation and putting that in the film. How did you go about winnowing it down to, for however many hours you talked to, say, Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, to get those specific quotes from him? What did you have to do to hone it down?
Reams of transcripts and doing paper edits, endless paper edits, and each of us having our favorite sound bites to discuss and cobble into a sensible narration. You're right, it took a lot of winnowing to get it down to the streamlined version that you see on screen now.
I don't think there was one moment, one nano of flab where I went, oh, that could have been edited a little bit tighter, because I've got that in the back of my brain at all times. It's kind of like, oh, this is going to be a slow movie because it's badly edited in the first 5 minutes. Nah, this thing barreled ahead. And yet, for all the intensity of information and intense information that you were providing, it was a clear, clean, smooth narrative that did not overwhelm because you provided so much of the human aspect of it. I mean, I cannot give you enough kudos on this film because I thought it was hands down brilliant, ultimate, and quite possibly a game changer in the dealing of the public with this entire industry.
Oh, Libby, thank you so much. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I wish Morgan was here to hear your kudos, too.
Yeah.
But we got really high praise from a New York activist who saw it the other day, and she said, SOS is for organizers. And I think that's largely a tribute to Mary Beth's input, because Mary Beth is the organizer in the family, and she used that perspective to polish the presentation from an activist point of view.
Was there a particular set of guidelines or perceptions or intentions on your part that you used to create the parameters for what you used and what you had to sadly put on the shelf for perhaps another time?
We sure do have a lot on that shelf for another time, I'll tell you. But I was constantly trying to winnow down to the basic issues that needed to be touched on, because even though we left out so much, it's still, you know, in an hour and a half film. The issues that, you know, I'm part of the decommissioning working group that meets nationally every Friday morning, and people talk about these issues all the time. So I was reminded what comes up, what needed to be said, what are the key problems here.
Our intention was to make it catalytic and empowering for people in other reactor communities around the country. That was a fundamental intention right from the beginning. Because like we say in the title, this is a syndrome that isn't limited to San Onofre.
The ethical discussion, the discussion about values, that our whole intention could be summed up in that focus, I think, that Dan so beautifully articulates, that it's such a challenge ethically.
Yeah, the basic question we're asking is, what is the ethical, environmental, and technological best practice combination that could be applied to this universal problem? And it can't just be technological, it can't just be moral and ethical, it can't just be environmental, it has to be an amalgam of all those dimensions.
That's part of, I think, what made it so complex yet so accessible. Because again, you laid it out in measured pieces, where a lot of times I will be watching a film. I've been a judge for the International Uranium Film Festival, so I've seen a lot of films. And sometimes with all best intentions, a filmmaker gives too much, or it becomes too jargonish. And it becomes difficult for, say, a lay person to watch this and understand, well, what's important about this and why does this relate to me and what did they just say and what does NRC mean? We can't take any of that for granted. And you didn't. The film is laid out so that even somebody who does not know about the issues can learn about them and can also learn what to do. So it's not just about, okay, here's a heap of bad news. It's like, here's a heap of bad news, and here's what you can do about it to empower yourself and empower your community and your neighbors to take action against the incursion of this deadly technology on our lives. And you basically gave them the script for how to proceed.
Thank you. I hope we did. And, you know, Gordon Edwards was so key. Oh, my God. When we heard him speak, of course, years ago, when Joanna Macy, who I don't know how many of your listeners know Joanna Macy, but she worked for years. She's a Buddhist scholar and anti-nuclear activist as well. And she came up with the concept of guardianship. It had to be, the nuclear waste had to be guarded. And I remember the first time I heard articulation of that concept, I burst into tears because I realized the importance of that understanding. And then when Gordon spoke about it at the conference in Chicago in 2015, I think it was, the NEIS organized for high-level radioactive waste focus nationally, and he spoke about the concept of rolling stewardship.
As opposed to abandonment.
Mm-hmm. And so we just thought, oh, that's it. That is it.
One of the first interviews of note that I did for Nuclear Hot Seat took a couple of months before people went, who's she? What's she do? Podcast? Who is this woman? One of the first big ones I got was Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. And this was all new information to me at the time. So I was talking with him about what do we do with the waste? And he was talking about the need for a nuclear priesthood. He was talking about this Joanna Macy concept of taking care of it in the long run, and that there would have to be people who are dedicated to this as their service to mankind.
Right. And that's the rolling stewardship. I prefer to think of it as skilled workers intergenerationally rolling, over their skills, their understanding, and their knowledge so that the next generation has it to deal with. Yeah, a little bit less
religious
tones.
Yeah.
I think it was the fact that he mentioned it as a priesthood that it really stuck with me, because that's a dedication of one's life to a set of beliefs. It doesn't have to be religious, but it is a dedication of a life. And that's what the rolling stewardship is as well.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Not just a life, but a whole societal orientation. That's the key to it. It has to become a societal response, not just a minority enthusiasm.
And most people, of course, at this point, don't even really know what's going on with nuclear things. I think that's one of the reasons why the Oppenheimer film had such shock value to a younger generation, because Heidi Huttner, who made the film Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island, another excellent film. She's a teacher at Stony Brook University. So she's dealing with college kids, and she teaches ecofeminism around that topic. And she had the class come in, and she said in a class of 30 to 40 kids, two or three of them had heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They didn't know about Three Mile Island. They had maybe heard the term Chernobyl, but they didn't know what it represented. And because it's more recent, more of them had heard about Fukushima. But they really have no knowledge, no context, no understanding of what nuclear is. They think radiation, oh, that's the treatment that mom got for her breast cancer. Mm-hmm. They don't think of it as that may have been the thing that gave her the breast cancer in the first place.
Or it's going to rescue us from climate change.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a big lie. I work on that one every week.
So do we. I read Heidi saying that about her class, and I was just horrified, but not too surprised, because a couple of years ago, or several actually now, I went to a neighbor's eighth grade class to see if we could do some work with them, and looked at their textbooks, which were teaching them that nuclear was absolutely necessary, and GMO to prevent starvation and all of this stuff. And then I discovered that the corporations were the ones who were writing the textbooks.
And they were writing it for an audience in Texas, because they are the largest purchasers of textbooks. And they've had the whip hand on that industry for decades now, which is why so much of the information that we would recognize as being true and important and cutting edge has been completely wiped out. So we almost have to start at the ground and work our way up in education. And I think your film does a superb job of not only stating what the problems are, but how individuals can get together and form little groups, little conglomerates of people who can then organize, strategize, coordinate, and make a difference.
Yeah, there's a wider context that we don't really have time to go into in the film, but that is that nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, and nuclear waste are like Siamese twins joined at the hip. They're all part of what Albert Meyer and other activists are calling the nuclear enterprise. For years, the pro-nuclear faction have denied that there's any connection between energy and weaponry. But now they're using that as the excuse for continuing the civil nuclear energy program because it's a vital support in terms of labor pool, knowledge pool,
infrastructure,
and so on, that supports the nuclear weapons enterprise and the nuclear navy, which is both propelled by and a delivery system for nuclear materials. And of course, both of those end up with the nuclear waste conundrum, for which even after 75 years, there's no perceivable solution. Eventually, I hope we'll be able to touch on that in future films if we live long enough. But I think this is a good start for alerting people to the perils involved.
I just want to add one thing, and that is the space program is a big promoter of the nuclear enterprise because they want to use it in all kinds of different...
Yeah, for power and delivery systems in space.
Right.
Give me a break.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and they want to have nuclear reactors for power on the moon. They want to have it on Mars and propel the ships there. Not thinking about the contamination risk that poses for otherwise nuclear pristine environments that have not been contaminated. I think it was the Voyager that was crashed into Jupiter. It had a payload on it of something like 73 pounds of plutonium in an environment we know nothing about. We have now contaminated it with man-made radioactive materials with no idea how that is going to play out over the centuries and the millennia into the future. It's like we are setting ourselves up for God and manipulating something that is not going to go away, that will be with us for virtually eternity with no concept of what we are doing or how we can possibly turn it around.
Hello, we're the humans from Earth.
You know, that also reminds me in the 50s about atomic bombs detonated in the jet streams,
and
right?
The Van Allen radiation belt.
The Van Allen belts, yeah. It's just idiocy.
Looking in the immediate, not short-sighted, but the short term, what are your plans for the film? I know it's been edited and put together and the soundtrack, and you said you had a few little tweaks like color correction and very techie movie things to do to it. But I've already posted about having seen the film, and I'm being bombarded by listeners saying, well, don't just tell us about it. Where can we find it? How can we see it? When will it be shown?
Well, I'm happy to say we are really busy cranking up the momentum to get it out there. The first opportunity is October 8th in Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, at the Awareness Film Festival. It'll be the closing night film, October 8th. That's a Sunday. And then we're going to have
a world premiere.
Yeah, that's our world premiere. And in-person premiere. And I hope you'll be there, Libby.
Oh, try and keep me away from it.
Great. There are various ways to get tickets.
I will, of course, post all of this on the website.
I mean, the key to all of this is that we've had the great good fortune to team up with Mocha Media, which is a group of highly capable, highly talented, multi-talented women who are filmmakers themselves as well as being experts at promotion. They're developing what is now called a new concept for me, Impact Campaign. And we're going to be developing relationships with reactor communities and educational outfits around the country to promote the film and promote the knowledge that it carries with it.
And I also wanted to finish with the other opportunities to see the film.
That's good, because they have people who are not in Los Angeles who are desperate to see it.
Okay, great. Well, there's going to be a screening in San Clemente, October 14th. And then there's going to be a screening in Laguna Beach, date to be determined. And there's going to be a virtual online presentation on the 15th, October 15th. That'll be through the Awareness Film Festival. And we will get all of those details to you so you can put them at the end of the program. Progressive Democrats of America are sponsoring a national screening, and also Sierra Club, a conservation group. So we'll be getting it out there. Definitely. And we'll have another online screening even after the October 15th with a full-on panel. We're just scrambling to get everything together as fast as possible and get it out.
Always get that information to me, because not only will I mention it on the show, I will post to it and link to it on the website. And I will also have that as part of my social media to let people know.
Thank you so much for your offering to get it out on social media, Libby. We really, really appreciate that and need it. And you know, what we really would like to do is particularly reach to the young folks, the younger generation, and in the Sunrise Movement and in Extinction Rebellion Movement, because all they've heard is that it's green and clean and should be used.
Well, we will take down the lies about nuclear, counteract it with the truth, as brilliantly put together as the two of you have in this film and in so many of the others that are coming out now. There seems to be this wash of really powerful films that either have come out or are in the process of coming out, all of which contradict the lies of the nuclear movement. And that, of course, is what this show is dedicated to. So I will be keeping as up to date as possible. Any breakthroughs you have, any new ways of people accessing the film, please get it to me immediately. I will get it out, because let's face it, you have covered in this film one of my two local nuclear nightmares, the other being Santa Susana Field Lab, only 30 miles away from my home. San Onofre is 70, and I've got a couple of sets of hills in between, but I have no illusions about being safe if those canisters start cracking and the radiation starts leaking. So whatever I can do to support this film, I have no compunctions at all, because it's the kind of work that deserves to go for Oscar viability, Oscar consideration, and I'm hoping that Netflix decides to pick it up.
Thank you for your wonderful vision. I love it.
Yeah, we've seen that there's an attempt at a nuclear revival going on. And the spate of films that are coming out now, we think, is part of a nuclear awakening to counteract that nuclear revivalism and recidivism, as you might call it. So thank you for your support and encouragement.
Thank you for being an overnight success with this film after more than 11 years of shooting it.
And I do want to say that, you know, there were three of us that did this. Morgan Peterson has just been brilliant, and we couldn't have done it without her.
And in the meantime, she's been having babies. She's just had two beautiful daughters in the last 3 years. So right. She has her hands full, but she's risen to the occasion.
And what better reason to fight against nuclear than children? As you can tell, I wish you every conceivable and inconceivable success with your new film. For now, Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle and all of those you worked with, I want to thank you so much for having been my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you, Libby.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle of EON, the Ecological Options Network. Their film, SOS, San Onofre Syndrome, will have its world premiere on October 8th, next Sunday, at the Awareness Film Festival being held at the Regal Theaters in downtown Los Angeles. For those of you living in the LA area who will be attending, I look forward to seeing you there. And for those outside of LA, the live stream will take place on Friday, October 13. There will be a link up to both of these on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 640. It also is possible for you to schedule your own screening of SOS, San Onofre Syndrome. And to do so, contact the filmmakers through their website, eon3.org.
Activists, shout out.
Lots and lots of action and activism taking place, and I love it. Code Pink reports that last weekend, 75,000 people in New York City marched to say war is not green, and people handed out flyers outside of showings of Oppenheimer to get thousands of signatures on their No Nukes petition. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, every year on September 26, marks the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons by showing the world that speaking up against nuclear weapons can happen at all levels and in many different ways. Over the past weeks, ICAN campaigners in Albania have projected a powerful message onto their parliament building, "Sign the Nuclear Weapons Ban TPNW Treaty Now." A UK-wide Day of Action, organized by CND UK, took place on Saturday, September 23rd, protesting the potential return of U.S. nuclear weapons to the United Kingdom. France's second-largest city, Lyon, endorsed the ICAN Cities appeal, calling on France to join the TPNW and ordering all banks to declare whether their policies include the TPNW in all their future dealings with the city. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the new executive director of ICAN, Melissa Park, delivered ICAN's statement to the high-level plenary meeting to commemorate and promote the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. We'll have a link up to the text of her full statement on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 640. The Grand Canyon Trust asks, "Can you walk 5 miles?" They're asking those who can to support the White Mesa Ute community by joining their annual spiritual walk and protest to protect their sacred lands from radioactive waste and the White Mesa uranium mill. You will be able to hear directly from community members and tribal leaders about the threats the mill poses to their water, air, culture, and health, starting at an 11 a.m. rally. All this takes place in White Mesa on Saturday, October 7. Tim Deer Jones, the UK-based marine biologist, wanted to let us know about a petition to remove the word clean from nuclear branding. He writes, "The nuclear industry is now calling itself clean at every opportunity, with this lie being repeated in schools and colleges and up and down the country, as well as in other nuclear countries. We owe it to future generations to tell the truth about nuclear, and the truth starts with reclaiming the word clean. This is a UK government petition, which was not an easy trick to pull off, and we'll have a link to it up on our website under this episode, number 640. Two important resources: a guide to the 450 land-based missiles of the United States is available through NukeWatch. It's a little horrifying to learn exactly how close these things are to where we live. And this just covers the 450 land-based nuclear missiles in the Great Plains. We will have a link, of course. And Hanford Challenge has just created a new resource page for Hanford workers in Washington State. Washington has passed what's called the Hanford Presumption Law, with the idea to make it easier for Hanford workers to get compensation when they get sick on site. The first resource page is about this law, with resources for workers to help them understand how it might help them. And if you are a nuclear worker and need assistance, reach out to Hanford Challenge at hanfordchallenge.org. If you're between the ages of 18 and 24, the International Atomic Energy Agency has just given you a great opportunity to speak truth to power. It is launching an essay competition to identify current global challenges and posit ways the IAEA, which here calls itself the World Center for Cooperation in the Nuclear Field. Well, they're not cooperating with us, but they want to know from you how they can make an even greater impact. Essay entries in the form of a speech will also be accepted. The winner will be invited to visit Vienna for a behind-the-scenes tour of the IAEA headquarters. So come on, all you young'uns. Take this opportunity to tell the IAEA what you really think they should be doing. Finally, I have a personal SOS for anyone in the greater Los Angeles area. Because of an infestation of nasty little critters in my storage space, I have to remove all my file boxes of nuclear hot seat files and find somewhere to put them. That's every file I have created since June 14 of 2011. It's a lot. Between the condition of my back and my bank balance, I can't handle this project alone and am faced with the awful possibility that I may have to dump all of the records of this show. It's much more than what you hear on each week's program. So here is the ask. If you are in Southern California and can store these boxes for an unnamed and undefined period of time, let me know. If you can help me physically move them out of storage and onto a truck for transport, let me know. If you have a truck that can be used for transport or just a big old van that can take a lot of boxes, let me know. Send me an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any part of this will be welcomed, as I have only 2 weeks to get this done. My schedule is already slammed, and I'll be honest, I need help. And if you know of an archive that might be willing to take this material so it is not lost, let me know that as well. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 26, 2023. Make certain you never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. You can sign up for it on whatever platform you use to get your podcasts, or the easiest way possible, just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box that pops up. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one email with the link and a short description of the show's content. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything, anything at all, we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, the names of the guest whose comments you use, and if you use anything of mine, me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, it's easy to characterize every citizen fight against nuclear incompetence, ignorance, and greed as a David and Goliath battle. And yes, it truly is. I just need to remind you, David won. There you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.